I always think of Kenya when I think about that song. I always say, well, the skies are bigger in Kenya, and they seem to be bluer. So this year I said I was going to really pay attention to Iowa skies, and guess what? Iowa skies are big, and Iowa skies are blue. I don't know why that song makes me cry, but it just makes me think about Kenya. Maybe I'm homesick for Kenya. Okay, let me gather myself here for a minute. Do we have any high school graduates in the audience? Okay, we got some back there. Recent? Oh, I mean recently. Not all of us are high school graduates. Okay, how many times in the past few months have you been asked, what are you planning on doing? What are your plans? What are you going to do? Once or twice? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I was your age some 49 years ago, and my answer at the time was I was going to be a nurse, just like this young, was it a young woman who said maybe she was going to be a nurse? Okay, I went, yes. I did not add that someday I would go to a hospital mission field in Kenya, but I remember watching presentations, it must have been evening meeting, where Edith Radcliffe or Mary Glenn Hadley were doing their slideshows, as they would do when they would come back on furlough, and I would think, wow, wouldn't that be great? But I kind of kept that to myself. I thought about it. I did start my nursing education at Iowa Lutheran Hospital in 1962. I got good grades my first semester. I was elected president of that preclinical class. I thought I was on top of the world. So imagine my surprise when at the end of the semester, nursing administration called me in and said, we think you need to find another different career. We think you don't have a personality becoming that of a nurse. We think you ask too many questions, and you challenge authority. Now, I thought I was to be an advocate for my patients and nurses. But remember, this was 1962. I think nurses were supposed to follow orders and do what the doctor says and don't raise any questions. Now, that is not true today. What we're looking for are men and women who can say, you know, I don't think that script is quite right. Or, I don't like how this patient looks, and use their own good judgment to, maybe I wouldn't use the word challenge, but help to bring the doctor into a better understanding of what the patient's needs are. Anyway, this all happened prior to the women's movement, happened prior to the civil rights movement, that was just beginning, happened prior to the Vietnam protests, all of which I was involved with as I lived my life. And I think I just said to myself, I justified by what was happening by saying, you know, I was ahead of my time. That was it. And I think it kept me from thinking about what the real questions were. What was nursing administration trying to tell me? And I entered a dark night of depression. And let's back up my story a little bit. I'm a birthright Quaker. Lawrence and Virginia Tatum of New Providence are my parents, and they served their entire lives at Quakerdale Home for Boys and Girls. Our daily devotions and prayers were all around service. I mean, there wasn't ever a time when we weren't talking about how we were going to be of service that day or in the future. I was surrounded by love and great values, but, you know, I ran away from it all. I spent my time trying to fix the outside because I was embarrassed and I thought I was a failure. Parker Palmer, how many of you are familiar with Parker Palmer? He's a Quaker author. He's written lots of great books, and he hadn't written this book when I really needed it. It's called Let Your Life Speak, Listening for the Voice of Vocation. It's an excellent book. Anyway, it would have helped me if I could have read it back then. He talks about his life being painful and messy. And I think the time and space I was trying to put between myself and this first nursing experience really didn't help me. It has taken me a long time to become the person I really have always been. God's call doesn't mean that life is going to be an easy road. I tried lots of things to make me feel better. I was goal-driven. I tried journaling and therapy, eating. I learned to sail. I learned to play tennis. Again, Parker Palmer asked me to consider not who am I, but whose I am. Recall with me the words of the hymn. We're going to sing it after the sermon. It's called, Is It I, Lord? I have heard you calling in the night. I will go, Lord, if you lead me. I will hold your people in my heart. The title of this sermon is called When God Calls. And the scripture comes from Romans 12, verses 6 to 8. Okay, now I found it just a minute ago. We have different gifts according to the grace given us. If a man's gift is prophesying, let him use it in proportion to his faith. If it is serving, let him serve. It is teaching, let him teach. If it is encouraging, let him encourage. If it is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. If it is leadership, let him govern diligently. If it is showing mercy, let him do it cheerfully. Finding your calling in life can be a source of great anxiety. What is our true purpose in life? I believe that is God's personal, individual invitation to carry out the unique task he has for you and me. That sounds simple enough, but how do you know when God is calling you? And is there any way that you or I can be sure you're doing the task assigned to us? Do we believe that God's call will come in the mail in a certified letter or through a strange email? No, we must first have a personal relationship with God. We are a busy nation. We're always doing something, trying to meet the challenges of life, often distressed and frustrated, and I should add worried. I believe that it is in the quiet and calm when we are in a state of reflection, or in a relative state of inactivity, that we can best hear the call. When we are angry or resentful or frustrated or bitter or worried, we are unable to hear what God wants to have emerge in our lives. I went through all of those emotions, refusing to listen to what God had in store for me. After my 30-year marriage dissolved and I had decided to leave a job that demanded a minimum of 60 hours a week from me, did God's calling start to emerge? At age 55, I asked myself, is it too late to become a nurse? I read an article in this month's AARP magazine that baby boomers are the fastest growing age group in U.S. divinity schools, increasing from 12% in 1995 to 21% in 2010. They quoted that many boomers, now they boomers are just a year younger than me. I'm a 1 year ahead of the boomers. They quoted that many boomers are looking to spend their time in ways that hold greater meaning and make a positive difference in the world. One man was quoted as saying he didn't feel the call of ministry until he was 55. I decided to follow this lifelong dream to become a nurse. The doors to my calling started to open. Parker Palmer talks about sometimes it's the doors that are closed that help you find your calling. Grandview University accepted me and said it appeared I could get my bachelor's in nursing in about 2.5 years. I applied for and received a student loan, which I think will finally be paid off when I turn 82. And if I die before then, I thank all of you in the audience for paying off my college loan. Thank you. I had many adventures along the way that were very rewarding and affirming that I was on my way to my calling. I graduated at age 62. I'm now 67. I passed the national nursing exam called NCLEX on the first try. Yes. I will admit to many prayers, but I also did my part and studied nonstop for 6 weeks. I prepared myself for the exam, and it was hard. Now, what was I going to do that I was a nurse? My psychiatric nursing professor, Deborah Kaysen, who's sitting right there, encouraged me to apply for a community mental health nursing job. I told her, I was headed to Kenya to volunteer in a health center in the largest slum in East Africa called Kibera for the summer. I said the only way I could apply for the job would be to job share it with someone who had summers off, like her. And now Deb tells a different story, but I have the podium, so you have to listen to mine. Deb opened another door by job sharing with me. We to this day provide nursing services to adults living in the community who have diagnoses of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and severe depression. It's challenging yet rewarding work. I went to Kenya in the summer of 2006, and Deb started our full-time job. In the fall of 2006, I was attending Honey Creek New Providence Friends with my mother, Virginia. Patrick Nugent, principal of Friends Theological College in Kaimosi, was speaking. After the meeting, most of the congregation headed to probably the only restaurant open in Hardin County called Pizza Hut in Eldora, Iowa. Because of the shortage of seating, Patrick sat with us. He quickly discovered I'd spent the previous summer volunteering as a nurse in Kibera. He asked me to come to Kaimosi Friends Mission Hospital and volunteer, and he gave me the email addresses for both Sylvia Graves and Eden Grace. Another door opened. Last year, Deb Kaysen traveled with me to Kaimosi and volunteered for a month. In less than 10 days, she will leave again to volunteer there for another month. On April 15th of this year, I returned home from my fifth year of service in Kenya for 3 months at a time and in Kaimosi at the Mission Hospital for the fourth year. Every year, when I return from Kaimosi, people ask, "Are you going again, Judy?" At first, I'm pretty sure I'll never go back, for the work is trying and the time away from family and grandchildren seems to get longer every year. I wonder how Mary Glenn Hadley stayed for 5 years before she had a furlough. I always question whether I'm serving to the best of my abilities. While the work may seem glamorous on this side of the ocean, it can be discouraging and frustrating on the other side. I always need a few months to mend and repair and meditate, although I did catch myself telling a friend this week, "When I go back." I remember what Irene Gulavi, my neighbor and head of the nursing service at Kaimosi, said to me when I was questioning my service. She said, "Judy, everything's a bit better when you're here." On the lighter side of returning home, I'm grateful for a hot shower. Water is a major issue in Kaimosi. I spend an hour every day collecting it, boiling it, filtering it. A bath means heating up the water on my stove and washing myself down before it cools. There's no restaurant in Kaimosi, and one can be found about an hour away in Kisumu, so I eat the hospital food every noon, which consists of rice or beans or cooked bananas or ugali or cooked cabbage. The food is very bland. No matter how hard I try to spice it up, my Kenyan friends, and to entice my Kenyan friends to eat it, it's really too strange for them. I use the local markets and cook local produce. Kenya does have the best avocados, pineapples, bananas, and mangoes in the whole world, but very few vegetables. They have something called Sukuma Wiki, which grows kind of like Brussels sprouts. You pick the leaves at the bottom, and then they chop it in little tiny ribbons, and they cook it with onions and tomatoes, sometimes some garlic. And that's what they eat every day with their ugali, which is a cooked corn meal. And it comes out like this, and they cut it in slices, and they use their hands, and that's what they use to scoop up the ugali. So I really like a spoon, but many a time I've used my natural one. One of the greatest trials of my heart this year was the discovery that some of our hospital patient attendants were calling themselves nurses and were treating patients in their own homes, which they call clinics. At a time when all the nurses quit the hospital due to not being paid for a long time, community people were hired and trained as patient attendants and were called nurses at the hospital. The hospital got a very bad reputation, which is still today trying to live down. Irene Gulavi, the head of nursing, and I arrived the same month in 2007. Irene quickly assessed the situation and set about to hire more nurses. You've seen the Adopt a Nurse program. That program has literally saved the hospital by providing the funds monthly to hire qualified nurses. The situation in Kenya is that there's kind of a hard dynamic. Most of the nurses are ones that are 55 or older and who have retired from government and come to work in the hospital. There are only two nurses who have worked there their entire lives, Elizabeth and Fannis. You'll see their pictures downstairs. And they hire brand new nurses right out of school because nurses have to work 1 year before the government will hire them. So imagine this, you have the retired nurses who've spent their life nursing and you have brand new nurses. Now that could be seen as, a dynamic interchange of ideas, but sometimes the old nurses get threatened by the young nurses and the young nurses think the old nurses aren't listening to them. But a time this year when I came, we were down something like 10. We only had 10 nurses and we needed at least 18. And the old nurses are the ones who kept the hospital going. But I can tell you at age 67, I can only work so many 10-hour days in a row before I'm tired and my clinical judgment flags a bit. So the Adopt a Nurse through the United States, supported by FUM, truly has made a difference. The Kenyan Nursing Council does not recognize patient attendants as a legal nursing cadre. So Irene has worked hard to move these individuals into continuing to help patients, but not give the shots, not insert the brannulas, not give the medications. They're not even supposed to do vital signs, but they do. One day this year, a 3.5-year-old little girl with severe burns died on our doorstep, in outpatient, before any treatment could be given. After some investigation, Irene discovered that one of our patient attendants had been treating this child for 12 days. The child had been severely burned by hot water, and the child had been taken to the patient attendant's clinic where she was treated and given injections. Of course, the family didn't know what the injections were. There had been rumors about these clinics, but no proof that they existed. I think Irene had finally just had enough, and she stepped in, and she took the situation to our interim administrator, who interviewed the people involved. The patient attendant was put on paid leave for 30 days, and the management team met finally to discuss the situation and interview the offending staff person. I maintained all the time that the hospital staff would be watching what we were doing, and the results of our action was going to send a strong message. When we discussed the situation with the offending staff member, she denied having treated the girl or having a clinic in her home. She showed no remorse. We decided to dismiss her, and then the lobbying began. Her father-in-law came to visit the administrator. Her neighbors came to visit the administrator. Friends came to visit the administrator, all begging to keep her job. A job in Kenya is like gold. Unemployment runs 50 to 60%. You may be willing and able to work, but if there's no job, then you're going jobless. So, and the Tariqis, which is the tribe of that community, are very patriarchal, and they very fiercely defend their own, whether they're right or wrong. My heart was broken. I questioned what I was doing when there was hospital staff who could have home clinics, taking patients away from the hospital and treating them without the proper education. Irene had suspected for a long time, as we'd have children come in with major complications with malaria when it should be just a simple protocol treatment and the children would go home well. But they would come in with complications, and she just couldn't understand that. And finally, she was beginning to see that these children were being treated in home clinics and were not getting well. We also questioned where were they getting supposed drugs. The doctor decided to do what we call a chart review of the use of Rocephine, which is a very powerful drug and very expensive, and it's given intravenously to sick patients. And he was very calmly and quietly doing this drug review, and when he was finished, when he knew which cases had been used, he went to the ward to check the injection book where the nurses chart every injection they've given. And when he looked for the period of time, he found that the binding had been cut and the pages were gone from the exact time he was looking and trying to check when the injections were given. So we knew that all of the staff knew that we were doing a review of what was happening to medications. So knowing Irene as I do, she said, I'm going to catch him. And so she set out to set up a different kind of system so that people would be more accountable, the nurses, for the medications that they were giving. Now, it doesn't mean that a nurse would particularly steal the medications, because people know where the key to the meds are, and they can get into those meds. So the hospital had a double problem. They were losing some expensive meds, and they had people treating patients in their own clinics. Now, all this time, the management team was working on trying to meet payroll, and they depend on the money from FUM to help make that payroll. And in my righteous self way, I just said, how could staff do this? We work so hard in the U.S. to pay for salaries, and then people betray their own jobs. And I still haven't made my peace with this, but it's one of the things as a Westerner, when you go to another culture and you're trying to see what's happening through their eyes, they've not received a raise in over 3 years. Does it make it right to steal from the hospital? No, it doesn't. But have prices gone up in Kenya? They've skyrocketed. The cost of maize has skyrocketed. Fuel has skyrocketed. Their charcoal has skyrocketed. And they're just searching for ways to pay their bills and raise their family. Now, I don't say this is right, but I guess I think about myself as a single mother trying to raise children. I wonder to what extent I might go. I was so heartsick that this could happen at our mission hospital. It was not my first disappointment, and it won't be my last. Our Western Christian values do not always mesh with Kaimosi Christian values. This is but one of the challenges that those of us who choose to serve in missions for any period of time face. Every year when I am serving on the mission field, and every year when I return home, I question whether this is God's calling for me. You know, I know that God's calling is not necessarily a one-time thing. It's a process. It's a journey of learning and questioning. And for you new graduates back there, I invite you, as you start your journey, to spend some time listening for your call, to learn from the experiences you're having in the moment, right now. And I guess that would apply to those of you in this congregation who are over 55. You know, it's a golden time to volunteer. You don't have to go for a whole year. You can go for a month. You could try it out by traveling with Karen Bauer. I think she goes for about 3 weeks. You could meet the people of Kaimosi, the Tarikis. You could build mud houses. You could help widows. You could try it out. And if Kenya seems too far away, go to Belize, go to Oklahoma, go to Meskwaki Indian Tribe. There's lots of ways that you can serve. So I invite you, at age 55 and older, it's not too late to answer God's call to volunteer. God's call is just a door away. A door may close, but I invite you to open the door.